So I'm pressing record. This sure is the start of a series that's shorter than originally was supposed to be on medical ethics and halakha. Today is going to lean very heavy on the halakha. Next time, which is about organ donation, I think is a really interesting intersection where ethics and Jewish law intersect and sometimes bump up against each other in some ways, at least modern ethicists. There are a number of areas that I've, just being a shul rabbi, I've learned that the pure halachic discussion doesn't exist in a vacuum. And that's probably true in many areas of life, but it's less relevant when you're talking about the kashrut of cheese and more relevant when you're talking about people's physical health. It's come up in areas, end-of-life issues are a significant area where ethics and halacha are both important, both have a lot to say, and are sometimes difficult conversations. Ethics, what's interesting about ethics is that they are somewhat malleable to the views of the society in which they're produced. And halakha does adapt and does change over time, but it's a much slower process. And these questions I find fascinating. This one in particular is one that's, I think, personal to many people in our community, personal to my family in particular. And so it's, I'm actually excited to do this and come out of it with some thoughts. So what I'd like to do today is really just a survey of many, many different subtopics, because when we're talking about fertility treatments in halakha and Jewish law, there are many numerous treatments. There are many permutations to those kinds of treatments, and each one of them really can be dealt with on its own. So we could have an entire class. We could do an entire 10-part series on the halakha and the ethics of fertility treatments, where you would do 1 week about sperm donation and another week about egg donation, another week about gestational carriers, and I'll define some of those terms as we go through it. But today's really an overview to just give us a broad sense and the kinds of questions that come up. And I'm going to try to leave some time for questions at the end. And I'm also just want to start at the beginning that I'm not a medical expert. We have a few doctors in the room, some medical and some otherwise. And if you please feel free to correct me if any of my medicine or science is not 100% correct.
Not too much pressure.
Just a little pressure is always a good thing. So let's get started with the discussion about fertility and halakha. The starting point that I think is one last note of introduction. I have been fortunate to learn a lot about this area from a few teachers in particular. One of them is Rabbi Baruch Simon, who's been here for Shabbat. He's the posek who I turn to for most of my halachic questions. He's the rabbi who I studied with for 6 years at Yeshiva University. And he happens to be an extremely sensitive person in general. He's extremely well-versed in the areas of family life and purity, Hilchot Midah, which are the ritual laws of family purity around menstruation, and that happens to have a lot to do with fertility treatments in the halachic process as well. So I learned a lot from him. I've also learned a lot from Rabbi Kenneth Brander, who had been at YU as the vice president, started his career in Boca Raton, where he built up the Boca Raton Synagogue, and now is the head of the Or Torah Stones Institutions, like 20 different yeshivas and seminaries and high schools in Israel. But in addition to all that, he's also a fertility he studied at Machon Pua, which I'll mention later. Machon Pua is an institute in Israel that specializes in fertility treatments and halakha. So he studied there. He became an expert there, and I've referred questions to him both in my personal and communal life as well. So he's another person to look out to. I'm going to take off my sweater so I don't fall asleep. If anyone else wants to adjust the temperature, feel free. Okay. The first starting point is that if you just look at the Torah, fertility and challenges with fertility are, in the Torah's view, one of the most significant challenges that a person can go through. You see this throughout Chumash. You see throughout the rest of the Torah. There's probably no moment in the Jewish calendar that highlights that more than Rosh Hashanah. Or if you look through the Torah readings of Rosh Hashanah, you see, hey guys, come on in. Hey, June. Okay, now, if there was a little bit of pressure with David, We now have a high-risk pregnancy expert here with another David. So feel free to correct any of my medical terminology here.
It's going to be all perfect.
Fantastic. Okay. I'm glad you're sitting right next to me. So Rosh Hashanah is this holiday where we have three stories of people struggling with fertility. It starts with Sarah, who's not able to have a child. Then the Haftorah deals with Chana and Elkanah when she cannot conceive, which is a major struggle in her life. And then continues with day two, struggles, familial struggles. But finally, we have an allusion to Rachel, to Rachel, who is also someone, hey there, who struggled to have children. Hey, Lizzie, do you have an extra source sheet?
We can check
on mine. And I don't think there's a more powerful line of human suffering and pain in the Torah than what Rachel tells her husband, tells Yaakov. That's verse one. This is when Rachel is barren. Vatere Rachel ki lo yalda. Rachel sees that she has not given birth, Yaakov. But tekane Rachel ba'achotah, and she becomes jealous of her sister, of Leah, who's had numerous children at that point. But tomer al Yaakov, and she says to Yaakov, hava li banim, give me children, v'im ayin meita anochi, and if not, it's as if I'm dead. Literally, if not, I am dead. Which is such a painful expression. And I think it's just important to recognize that the Torah validates pain. This type of pain around fertility challenges can be extremely isolating for people who are going through it, people who are trying to have children and have not been able to succeed. Often it can lead to a lot of loneliness, particularly in Jewish communities, where so much of many Jewish communities is centered around family life. And then you have individuals who have been trying to have families. Sometimes they're married couples, sometimes they're singles who would like to be married. There are many different permutations of that. But it's an unavoidable truth that it's a very difficult and potentially isolating situation to be in a community and not be able to match that family life that many others in Jewish communities have. So one of the beauties of Jewish community is that we are really oriented around family life, and it's just impossible to avoid that kind of pain that often can happen. And there are many organizations that are doing great work around sensitizing Jewish communities to that kind of pain and to that struggle. I'll mention a few of them as we go through. There's a fascinating idea that Rabbi Brander, who I mentioned before, shared about the struggles of fertility. And this is a bigger philosophical question, and given that we have a few doctors in the room, you probably can take your own opinions on this. But one can make the case that if an individual or a couple is struggling with fertility or with any health issue, one can make a philosophical point, which is maybe that's the way God wants it. It's a legitimate point, and you could really argue that from, I think, many perspectives. You could probably find proof text for that, that if God placed me in the world without certain abilities or with certain challenges, who gave me the right to try to change that? And there, Rabbi Brander pointed to a text in the Talmud that at first glance seems to be about something very different, but actually speaks to this question. And this question is particularly relevant when it comes to having using fertility treatments in particular. There were poskim throughout the last 50 years who strongly rejected the idea of any medical intervention, and basically said if God wants a person to have children, then they'll conceive naturally, and otherwise, no luck. If you look at Jewish history, there aren't many, but there are a few examples of Jewish thinkers who rejected the ideas of medicine. An important one among them is Rav Nachman of Breslov. So if anyone follows the Hasidic movement, Rav Nachman of Breslov, in his writings, was very skeptical about doctors, felt that basically one should have full trust in God. I guess it's kind of the Jewish version of Christian Science. Mm-hmm. If I'm getting it, is that Christian
Science?
Jewish Science, which is a denomination of Christianity that rejects any doctors and basically says one can only rely on prayer. And so you couldn't actually make an argument, and Rabbi Brander said that this text in the Talmud speaks to that potential question. So let's read it together. Allison, do you want to read for us? This is source 2 in Masechet Shabbat 31a.
And this is the question that Turnus Rufus the Wicked asked Rabbi Akiva. If your God loves the poor, for what reason does he not support them himself? Rabbi Akiva said to him, he commands us to sustain the poor so that through them and the charity we give them, we will be saved from the judgment of Gehenna. Turnus Rufus said to Rabbi Akiva, on the contrary, it is this charity which condemns you, the Jewish people, to Gehenna, because you give it. I will illustrate this to you with a parable. To what is this matter comparable? It is comparable to a king of flesh and blood who is angry with his slave and put him in prison and ordered that he should not be fed or given to drink. And one person went ahead and fed him and gave him to drink. If the king heard about this, would he not be angry with that person? And you, after all, are called slaves, as it is stated, for the children of Israel are slaves to me. If God decreed that a certain person should be impoverished, one gives him charity, one who gives him charity defies the will of God. Rabbi Akiva said to Turnus Rufus, I will illustrate the opposite to you with a different parable. To what is this matter comparable? It is comparable to a king of flesh and blood who was angry with his son and put him in prison and ordered that he should not be fed or given to drink. And one person went ahead and fed him and gave him to drink. If the king heard about this once his anger abated, would he not react by sending this person a gift? And we are called sons, as it is written, you are sons of the Lord your God.
It's a beautiful text and a beautiful argument. It's hard to imagine that historically Turnus Rufus, who's a Roman general who raised the Temple Mount, I think 70 years after the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, came and basically plowed the entire mount and turned it into Aeolia Capitolina, if I'm not, I think I'm probably mispronouncing that. But he turned Jerusalem into a pagan temple by raising the ruins of the Beit HaMikdash of the temple. So it's hard to imagine that Rabbi Akiva actually had a conversation, but what the rabbis in Talmud here are doing is pitting two worldviews against each other. They're pitting the worldview of Rome, represented by Turnus Rufus, against the worldview of Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva is someone we know in his own life who believed in miracles. Rabbi Akiva, just as an example, would expound on every single kutz, every single, just the tiniest part of a letter. And he had a very imaginative way of interpreting the Torah. He very much interpreted the Torah through miracles, through the supernatural. And he viewed God as all-powerful. But not only did he view God as all-powerful, he viewed man as having the capacity to do things that were improbable of humanity. So it's not coincidental that Rabbi Akiva was the main supporter of the Bar Kokhba revolts. He said Bar Kokhba should be thought of as Mashiach, as the Messiah. That, you know, we have power to alter our destinies. And just imagine that in this conversation here, Turnus Rufus is basically taking a view that whatever we are, whatever fate we're born into is the one that we're meant to have. And Rabbi Brander read into this Talmud, you can make the argument, right, from the Turnus Rufus argument, which is, whatever God gives a person in terms of their physical health, in terms of their body's capacities, that's what it's meant for them. And the Rabbi Akiva response is, one second, we're able to intervene on behalf of man. And he's, you could say this is an argument for medicine in general, but I think it's particularly powerful when it comes to fertility treatments, which is, this is how Rabbi Brander explains it. We're not necessarily only the servants of God, we're also God's divine partners. And God puts us in the world to try to elevate his creation even more. Rabbi Soloveitchik in Lonely Men of Faith refers to this as the majesty of man, as the ability of man to take the world as it is and to enhance it, to make it better, to conquer the world. That's his language. And Rav Soloveitchik particularly views medicine as one of the primary ways that humanity can be majestic. We're partners with God. We're God's children. We're there to continue the world, the work that God has already started. And one of the ways we do that is through medical innovations. So that's the view that I very much subscribe to. I've benefited from it in my personal life. There are post-game, famously the Satmar Rebbe, was very opposed to any kind of medical intervention in fertility. And so that's something that was, you know, in the Hasidic world, you'll see not all Hasidic groups, but you'll see some Hasidic groups strongly oppose any kind of medical intervention. That being said, the monorthodox world, and I think even nowadays, the majority of the ultra-Orthodox world, too, does very much endorse medical intervention when it comes to fertility treatments. Again, you have this tension, right? On the one hand, we want to be humble and accept what God gives us. On the other hand, creating family life and creating children is such a primary Jewish value. And those two things tend to are somewhat in tension with each other, but creating families seems to be the overriding value that wins for the vast majority of the Jewish community.
It's not just a value, it's a mitzvah.
It is a mitzvah. So that, at some point, it's worth us talking about that mitzvah. Uzi, would you mind turning down the heat a little bit? How's everyone else feeling? I just have it blowing straight at me. And with...
I took my jacket.
Okay. So you know what? On the bottom right.
Off.
Yeah, let me just do it quickly. Okay. Okay. So we have this mitzvah in the Torah. Some would say it's the first mitzvah that's given to humanity. Pru urvu umilua ta'aretz. Be fruitful, multiply, and fill the world. There are. Classically, that is understood. I'm just going to kind of go through the high-level understanding. That is classically understood to be an obligation upon men and not upon women, which is an interesting statement. Some commentaries... So, yeah, it's a great point. Some commentaries have said it's because...
I'm not a doctor, but...
You know, some commentaries said because biologically women are more wired to want to have children anyways, and men would be less likely to kind of have that innate desire, that there's a mitzvah for men and not for women. I don't know. I'm just presenting it the way that the Talmud presents it. There's a debate in the poskim whether there's a secondary mitzvah of Lashevet Yitzurah, that we are created in order to establish the world. There might be a second biblical commandment that applies to both men and women. Happens to be that this question comes up towards the beginning of what I was planning on talking about with regards to what if a couple can't conceive naturally. What is the barrier that they're obligated to pursue from a halachic perspective? Like, how far do you go to fulfill a mitzvah if it's withheld from you easily, if it's not easily attainable? And so there are Talmudic, this comes up in a whole bunch of areas. There's a Talmudic sugya that discusses if you washed and you ate food and then you walked away, how far do you have to go back in order to bench in the place in which you ate? And the Talmud says, well, you know, if you have to walk several miles, then you might be exempt. But if it's a closer walk, you might have to go back anyways to do the mitzvah at the highest level. So there are lots of conversations like this of how far do you have to push the mitzvah puravu. And we'll get back to that soon. Before we do that, I just wanted to define infertility so we're all working with the same terminology. The World Health Organization, according to a Google search that I did today, but this is consistent with all the pastoral training that I received, defines infertility as the failure or the inability to become pregnant after 12 months after a full year of trying to have a pregnancy. There's different kinds of infertility. Some people focus more on the inability to get pregnant. Some people focus more on the inability to carry a pregnancy through term. David, you can, if my science is off here, let me know. An important distinction in the fertility world is primary versus secondary infertility. Primary infertility is a couple who's not yet ever been able to conceive, and secondary infertility is a couple that might already have one or more children and is not able to have any more for medical reasons. So it's worth saying that those are different kinds of pains, but they're painful nonetheless, that people who might already have children but would like to have more can feel in their own way isolated, and sometimes almost just as isolated as someone who has not yet had any children. I thought there was a powerful reflection that Rav Simon quoted from Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who's one of the poskim who we're going to refer to the most today. Rav Moshe Feinstein says that pru urvu, the mitzvah to have children, is one of the few commandments that is not put in human control. If you want to light Shabbat candles, more or less, you can go buy the tools and you can light Shabbat candles. If you want to put on tefillin in the morning, right? If you have a pair of tefillin, you can just put it on. But there is a mitzvah pru-revu that is really not only in human hands, or at least not in the hands of an individual couple or an individual person. It seems to speak to another statement in the Talmud that there are three partners in the creation of a child. There's a mother, a father, and God, and it seems like it requires all three in order to have a biological child, and that's a challenge because it's not all in our hand, and sometimes. I remember having a close friend in another community who said sometimes the answer is no. And you can pray and you can do all the intervention, and there are people who spend tens of thousands and even hundreds of thousands of dollars and don't succeed in their journeys to have children. And I think that's just a powerful reflection that it's a mitzvah that we don't have control over. That being said, so there is this question of, well, how far does a person have to go? And there's a beautiful statement in the Talmud. This is source 4. Rava is quoted, so Rava is one of the later Amoraim, that when a person dies and leaves this world and makes it to the Pamalia Shalmala, to the palace above, King Floyd had a song about this, the great gig in the sky, something in the sky. Okay, the pearly gates, right? Then when you're on your way in, you're asked a series of questions. And the questions are, this is source 4, the same page as before in Masechet Shabbat, that when a person is brought to Din, that's like where they meet the heavenly court for the first time, Omrim Lo, they ask them a few questions. Nasata v'natata b'emuna, did you do your business dealings honestly? That's the first question. Kavata itim l'Torah, did you establish fixed times for Torah study? Asakta b'puria v'ridia, did you deal with being fruitful and multiplying? Tzipita l'Yeshua, did you look forward to redemption? Pilpalta b'chachma, did you engage in, pilpul is modernly interpreted as like complicated logical laws, like the kind of complexity of the halachic process or wisdom. Hevanta davar mitoch davar, did you try to learn one thing out of another thing? These are different kinds of wisdom. One of the interesting points, though, is the question about being fruitful and multiplying. The Torah didn't say pirita viravita. Rava says the question is not were you fruitful and did you multiply, but the question is asakta bipiria viridia. Did you deal with the mitzvah of being fruitful and multiplying? Did you make an effort? Yeah. And we have a similar, we use that same language in one of the morning blessings, the blessing of Torah study, where we say, "Blessed are you, God, who commanded us, la'asok v'divrei Torah, osek," to deal with, to engage in the study of Torah. And many of the commentaries point out that the mitzvah of Torah study is not, did you memorize X numbers of laws, or did you go through X tractates or books of Tanakh? That's not the mitzvah. The mitzvah is not the end game. It's not the outcome. It's about the process. Did you try to go through that process? And the reading of the Talmud that I found really powerful is that that's the question that we're asked in the world to come. It's not did you succeed in bringing children into this world. It's did you engage in the process? Did you try? And this is a great example of the Mishnah that you're not. A person is not obligated to finish the work, but they're not. Neither are they free to exempt themselves from it. There is a mitzvah to try. There's not a mitzvah to succeed necessarily. That's how Rava interprets the mitzvah of the Puruvu. It's the attempt. And that being said, there are poskim who say that the attempt should only be limited to natural means and not to fertility treatments or to medical interventions. I just wanted to quote you one of many places where you might find this, the Tzitz Eliezer, this is source 5, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, he was the rabbi of Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem. Hadassah is probably one of the most important Jewish medical institutions in the world, and he was the rabbi for many decades. And Rav Waldenberg, in the course of his time being the rabbi of Hadassah, wrote many, many volumes of Shelo to Tshuvot, of responsa literature, about the medical questions that he was asked at Hadassah. And he was one of the first people who was asked about in vitro fertilization. I'll define that in a little bit. And the Tzitz Eliezer, of Eliezer Waldenberg's approach to IVF, was basically, there are a lot of complicated questions that come out of IVF, halachically, and it's not really clear that you're obligated in the first place. He took the position, and it's a minority position, that anything that does not involve natural conception does not count as the mitzvah puravu, does not count as fulfilling the mitzvah. Maybe you're doing something else. Maybe it's always good to bring a new soul into the world, but it doesn't necessarily fulfill this technical obligation of being fruitful and multiplying. And so he basically said, you're likely not fulfilling the strict letter of the law, mitzvah, and there's a lot of other complications that come along with it. Like, it's not worth it. And he actually advised against IVF treatments. I think that's different in his own shuvot. He was more in favor of other, like, kind of quote-unquote simpler forms of fertility treatments, like an IUI, which is artificial insemination. But that's just one example. Many post-game, and I heard Ruf Simon say this specifically, while many post-game disagree with Reuval Altenberg, and the consensus in the Orthodox world is that IVF is allowed and encouraged, but many post-game say that if a couple has tried naturally, they're not obligated to do these extraordinary efforts to have biological children. Right? Again, it's asakta. Did you try? You tried, but there's a limit to how far one has to go. And sometimes a person could just say, like Ad Kan, I tried, but I don't have to do every single medical procedure. And so it's an interesting case of, like, how far does one have to go to try to fulfill a mitzvah. I'll say, opposed to the Tzitz Eliezer, the vast majority of post-game assume that medical interventions do fulfill the mitzvah of peruvu, of creating children. That seems to be the consensus approach. But despite that, even if you would fulfill the mitzvah, which we normally assume you would through IVF or IUIs, etc., one is not necessarily obligated to do them. Okay. So before we go into the specifics of fertility, I don't think it would be responsible to teach this class and not talk about genetic testing. Genetic testing is really, really important. There was interesting questions being asked of Moshe Feinstein in the 70s and 80s when Tay-Sachs was just becoming apparent. Tay-Sachs is primarily an Ashkenaz genetic disease that has pretty very negative outcomes. And he was asked, is it appropriate for people to get tested for Tay-Sachs? And it wasn't only can people get tested, but it was what should the testing look like societally. So Rav Moshe Feinstein was probably the major POSEC of American Jewry, particularly of the ultra-Orthodox world, lives on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And Rav Moshe kind of came up with this approach where he basically said, you know, there is a lot of importance. He seemed to describe it not as a halachic obligation, but a moral obligation, which is interesting that a POSEC like Rav Moshe kind of made this a little, say, pseudo-halachic as opposed to strict halachic. But he was very concerned about other factors. One factor was the self-esteem of someone who would find out that they had a genetic condition. That was a major concern of his. And the second was, it's harder to relate to in Oakland, California. It's easier if you grew up living in Borough Park, which is the stain that it would place on a family if someone found out. If the Yentas started talking and saying, oh, did you hear that so-and-so had a genetic condition? Particularly when it comes to shiduchim, when it comes to matchmaking, that if the word would get out on the street that so-and-so had a genetic condition, people would refrain from marrying any of their siblings or even cousins potentially. So there was a major concern about confidentiality and privacy. Because of those two things, the Haredi world has very much gone in favor of genetic testing. They've done it through a fascinating approach. It's an organization called Dor Yesharim. Has anyone heard of that? Dor Yesharim literally means a just generation or a straight generation. And how Dor Yesharim works is that across the board in all the Litvish institutions, and I think the Hasidish ones too, when a person's a teenager, they get tested. They get a suite of genetic tests, but they're not told how they test on them. They're just given a number. It's basically like you're given a barcode, or like a pin. A pin code might be a better description. And whenever a family wants to read a shidduch, that's Yiddish for when they want to suggest one person to another person, before they even suggest the match, they call up Dor Yesharim. They give the two numbers, and Dor Yesharim says either go ahead or don't go ahead, and Dor Yesharim basically keeps a private database of all these people's genetic results and makes the decision on their own. But by keeping it totally anonymous, if you get the answer, don't go out with so-and-so, you don't know, was it your fault? Like, was it one person, one side or the other side? No one knows. No one knows what the potential concerns are. And it's definitely a way to create, first of all, if you're concerned about the self-esteem issues, it's a way to obviate those, and it's also a way to protect the reputations of different families. On the other hand, I mean, personally for us, we just went ahead and did normal screening. YU had its own screening organization for a long time. Their J Screen is very popular, and I very much recommend it. It's very easy to get screened. And there's a counterpoint. If you wanted to read it in the source later, Rabbi J. David Bleich, who's a contemporary medical halachic expert, he basically says that he, I think he calls it hocus pocus. I think that's his. You can read the quote for yourselves later on the second page. And he also says, like, the fact that you're giving people codes instead of telling them what their actual results are just reinforces this stigma around the genetic conditions that you're trying to protect them from. So it becomes like a self-reinforcing issue. In the modern Orthodox community, I don't think it's common to go through Dori Sharim. Dori Sharim, interestingly, is very self-protective. So if you've gone through anonymous testing, I don't think they let you into the Dori Sharim. If you've gone through normal testing, I don't think you can get into the Dori Sharim system afterwards, because they very much want to protect the privacy and the secrecy around it. In the modern Orthodox community, I think open testing is much more common. And I can just say, I have a cousin who I'm very close with who has become a leader of this movement in Montreal for genetic testing, because after she and her husband had their second child, they found out that there was a serious genetic condition that their child has. Their child, thank God, is happy and healthy, but it risks impacting their lifespan and their quality of life. They've never been in a regular school. And these are things that genetic testing could easily have prevented. Question is, what do you do with that knowledge when you have, right, when you become aware of genetic results? So the Dori Sharim approach is you just don't let the couple go out in the first place, which is much easier to do in a world in which, you know, the parents are controlling everything about who dates who. In a world in which children have, children are adults and have their own autonomy to make their own decisions, there are other options, and that's actually one of the forms of infertility, and that's the one that Meir and I dealt with, which is when you have genetic issues that you have to proceed through if you want children. And there are options available, but they go through significant medical interventions. And so that's a good segue for our next section, which is an overview of some of the options. So, and here, please correct me. Do you see the area, headline of an overview of options? Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm going to run through them with relatively quickly. IUI, intrauterine insemination, or artificial insemination, is basically when a man's sperm is taken and is placed into, correct me if I'm wrong, the fallopian tubes of a woman, with the hope that if there's been a difficulty with male infertility, or even with female infertility, that it'll ease the shidduch between sperm and egg. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, into the uterus and eventually
into the uterus. Okay, thank you. Sorry. The second one that I know a little bit more in detail is IVF, or in vitro fertilization. So that's when a woman will have numerous weeks or even months of hormones injected that will, instead of allowing one egg to come out in a menstrual cycle, will release multiple eggs, hopefully many eggs. And then those eggs are harvested. I think that's the terminology. Mm-hmm. And once the harvesting takes place, the hope is that many eggs are harvested. Then in a laboratory, I think that's what the word vitro is, like in a... in a petri dish. Yeah, outside of the body, then the sperm is taken from a man and there is an insemination made. There are two kinds of IVF. There's one where they just allow the semen to try to penetrate the egg in a petri dish on its own. And then there's a second called ICSI, where there's, a tiny needle that goes into the egg and places the sperm directly inside it, which can help in certain circumstances. My understanding is that it's not always recommended, and it kind of depends on what the specific case is and what doctor's specific preferences are.
ICSI is more for sperm problems.
Okay. So it helps the sperm along its way.
Or taking out the best ones and injecting it directly into the egg.
So it's not Russian roulette with sperm.
Yeah.
Okay. That's IVF. Happens to be that whatever number of eggs you get, you can assume that there's basically going to be a 50% drop off of those. So if a person's only starting with one or two eggs, then it could mean that either IVF's not going to work at all, or many, many rounds of IVF have to be attempted. Just for what it's worth, an average round of IVF is between, I think, $15,000 and $25,000, give or take. So these things can add up very quickly. And most insurances don't cover them in the States. I know people who have moved to Israel specifically because they have fertility challenges. And in Israel, it's all covered by insurance. So, you know, everyone has a reason to make Aliyah. I guess that's one of them. It's pregnancy through a sperm donor. Sorry, before that, IVF with PGD testing. PGD testing is basically you create these embryos in the laboratory. You allow them to grow for several days. And then they're frozen and they're taken to the labs and tested against any possible number of genetic issues. What's fascinating and complicated about PGD that we'll talk about later is it basically allows, to the extent that we know anything about genetics, that you can select in and out for certain genetic factors. With PGD, it's possible to select what kind of what gender of a child you want. I think there are Asian countries where people will try to do this specifically because they'll be able to have a boy instead of a girl. So it's fascinating. It's a major ethical question. When I mention ethical questions, I'm going to get back to this one as we go through it. Sperm donors, egg donors, surrogates are all important. Sperm donors, I think, are often done through artificial insemination. On the other hand, egg donors and surrogates, which I'll define in a moment, normally come along with in vitro fertilization, with IVF. So an example of where a sperm donor would work, or how that would work, is that you have potentially a couple that wants to conceive a child, but the woman is not able to, either her eggs are not viable, let's say her eggs are not viable, so one can find a egg donor who goes through the first part of IVF, which are the hormones that release the eggs, and then that person donates their eggs to the couple that's trying to conceive. Those donated eggs are then fertilized with the male partner's sperm and are then placed in the female partner's body. There are more hormones than to hope that the egg is actually taken by the body and connects to the uterine lining, and then that could lead to a successful pregnancy. The other side of a surrogate, and sometimes you can actually have people who use both an egg donor and a surrogate, and they sometimes are three different. So sometimes you'll have an egg donor, a surrogate, and then the hopeful mother at the same time. So you can end up having like many different pieces of this puzzle. A surrogate would be if a woman has found out that she cannot carry her own child. There are many different reasons. I think if a person has had her uterus removed, that might be one reason that you would have a surrogate. Correct if I'm wrong. Okay. There could be others as well. We have friends who were not able to have, were not able to carry pregnancies to term, and after many, many attempts found a surrogate that they used. Surrogacy is more complicated just practically. It's much harder to find a surrogate. You're basically asking or hiring someone to get pregnant and carry a baby to term for 9 months, which is a huge ask. Not that an egg donor is not a huge thing as well. The next piece in the puzzle of fertility treatments often is adoption, which different families feel differently about, and it could be a beautiful way to create a family. And the last thing that I think has only become possible in the last 10 years or so is freezing of eggs. And that's something that I actually think should be spoken about more in the Jewish community and in the Orthodox community than it is. Fertility rates seem to really drop at around 35 years for women. And the difference of freezing for a woman to freeze her eggs in her early or mid-30s versus trying to get pregnant through fertility treatments in her late 30s or early 40s can be a massive difference. It could save a tremendous amount of heartache and a tremendous amount of expense if women were to freeze their eggs at a younger age. So I think this is specifically helpful in the Orthodox world for women who are single in their early 30s and would like to have children and don't want to feel like there's a biological clock ticking, basically ticking down their possibility of having a family. Many post-scheme nowadays strongly advocate for freezing eggs, which I think is an important piece of the fertility puzzle. And it helps in some cases and it doesn't help in others. But that at least helps with the biological clock issue if a person freezes her eggs early enough. Okay. I wanted to at least address a few of the halachic issues that we're going to come up against. There's an issue that's referred to in the Jewish community as halachic infertility, which means that biologically a couple might be able to conceive, but their halachic commitments might make that conception difficult or impossible. So I'll actually start with that. There is an issue that comes up in many of these treatments of hashkata zera levatala, which is a prohibition primarily for men about spilling seed. There's debates, is that a biblical prohibition or a rabbinic prohibition, but that factors into almost all of these discussions in some way or another. There are the laws of family purity that go back to halachic infertility that I'll mention later. Major questions that come up primarily when you're dealing with any kind of donors, so that could be sperm donors or egg donors or surrogates, which is what is the halachic status of a child? Let's say if a child is conceived by a couple with an egg donor, who is the halachic parent of the child? Is it the egg donor or is it the surrogate and vice versa? So these questions are major, major questions that get asked. And you're basically asking what defines halachically maternity. Who is a halachic mother in any of these cases? Separate question that is fascinating. In many of these procedures, you have rabbis endorsing rabbinic supervision, hashgacha, basically like kashrut, but for genetic material. And this has become a growing movement in the Orthodox world where the concern is that there were articles came out, I think already going back a few decades, that fertility clinics were not doing everything kosher. And people's genetic material got mixed up, and someone ends up having a child that they think is their own, and then they find out that it's actually not their biological material, which in the Orthodox world creates questions about halachic identity, Jewish identity. And so there's a movement now to basically say that you need to have rabbinic supervision for any procedure done in a fertility clinic, which is fascinating and much easier, again, if you live in Brooklyn or Teaneck, New Jersey, than if you live in Oakland or Oregon. But it's worth just mentioning that. Many fertility questions, particularly IVF, where you, at least in the early stages of IVF, often people would put in multiple embryos with the hope that at least one or two of them would take. But sometimes, if you end up like remembering some of these stories about the octopus moms in like the early 2000s, when a woman would have like 8 children all at once, oftentimes those were caused by fertility clinics putting in many fetuses. And the question is, often if there are too many fetuses, it can endanger the life of the mother. It could also endanger the success of any one of those pregnancies if you have too many in there. So a major question then becomes abortion-related, of can you reduce a pregnancy from 3 to 2 or from 5 to 3 in order to maintain the viability of some of the fetuses? It's fetuses, right? I'm looking at my grammar experts. There's sex selection and questions about single-parent families that are being very actively discussed in the Orthodox world, particularly now in Israel, in the religious Zionist community. The question of single mothers becoming parents is becoming much more discussed, where there are many women in their late 30s, early 40s who have been dating for 15, 20 years, have not yet found a partner, feel very much their biological clock's ticking, and they want to be able to have children. But it's also I'd probably describe it as a pseudo-halachic question, which is, you know, what's the ideal way to bring a child into the world? And these questions are being discussed right now in Israel. So, for the lack of time, I'm going to go through things quickly. The first issue that I want to talk about is halachic infertility. And this comes up more than people realize in the Orthodox world. This question, I can imagine permutations of it coming up under different circumstances, but particularly comes up for couples who observe family purity. A very short primer in Hilchot Nida on family purity is, just as a reminder, is that while biblically speaking, what family purity would mean is that nida is menstrual blood that leads to a 7-day count. And after 7 days of first seeing menstrual blood, dam nida, a woman would go to the mikvah after the 7th day at night and would go to the mikvah and would then be able to sleep with her husband and potentially become pregnant. The rabbis actually quoted, I'm going to go back to this graph, but all this is in your source sheets if you'd like later. The rabbis, though, point out that there are two forms of female ritual impurity that are very similar to each other. There's nida, which is menstrual blood, and there's ziva, or dam zivut, which is a non-menstrual flow or non-menstrual blood. And the way it's defined is that zivut is blood that would happen not during the normal time in a woman's menstrual cycle. And zivut also has a seven-day count. The difference, though, is that biblically, and this is the verses in Leviticus in source 6 and Vayikra point say this explicitly, is that while nida status, the seven-day count starts at the beginning of the flow, at the beginning of the menstrual flow. When it comes to zivut, when it comes to zava, if it's a significant flow, and I won't define that for now, which is defined as a flow of a few days, let's say 3 days, then the count can only begin at the end of the blood, at the end of the flow. And so that means that now if a woman bleeds for 4 days, biblically speaking, day 1, 2, 3, 4 are days of the menstrual cycle. Day 5, 6, 7 is days of count, continuing of the count. And then after 7 days, a woman goes to the mikvah. However, the rabbis say, it's a fascinating statement, it's referred to as the chumrah de Rabbi Zera, the stringency of Rabbi Zera, that's source 7. It's quoted throughout the Talmud, it's in Brachot, it's about to come up in the Daf Yomi. The stringency of Rabbi Zera is that Benot Yisrael Hechmiru al Atzman, the daughters of Israel, took upon a stringency, which is that any time they saw any blood, they treated it as the second type of blood, which means that any time there's a menstrual flow, you don't start the count at the beginning of the flow, but only after the flow is finished. Which means now that if you're counting days for an average menstrual flow, you're starting to talk about a 10 or an 11-day period. And on top of that, there's a stringency in the Talmud that, which I won't get into, that leads Ashkenazim to assume that from the beginning of bleeding, a woman waits 5 days and then starts her 7-day count. For some Sephardic Jews, it could be up to 5 days if that's how long a woman's menstrual flow is, but then it's 4 days, in many cases, not in all cases. And after 4 days, then the count starts. So in any case, now you're talking about 11, 12 days a month that women who observe Tara Mishpacha cannot have sex and cannot conceive. Happens to be that this works well for many women. I'm just going to go back to this nice chart here of how long does ovulation last. Peak ovulation. Ovulation is the moment where the egg, I believe, falls through the fallopian tube and becomes accessible to sperm so that the egg can be fertilized and a pregnancy can occur. And that normally happens, if I'm not mistaken, 14 days ovulation, 14 days before the end of a cycle, as in 14 days before a menstrual flow begins. Right? So that works well if a woman has a month-long menstrual flow. What that basically means, sorry, and part two, menstrual cycle. Most women whose only fertility issues are the normal cycle can become pregnant if they have sex 2 to 3 days before ovulation and then some short amount of time after ovulation. So for women who have a 28-day cycle, ovulation is taking place at day 14 or so. And that means that there's 2 or 3 days before ovulation where a couple can have sex and can become pregnant. But what if a woman's cycle is 24 days or 25 days? That means that ovulation is taking place right before she goes to the mikvah. Similarly, another form of this halachic infertility is what if a woman has a lot of staining during the 7 days where there's blood stains that might require her to wait longer before she can go to the mikvah. So she might still have a 28-day cycle, but she might only go to the mikvah day 15 or 16. And so these kinds of questions actually create a halachic impossibility of pregnancy, or at least making pregnancy far less likely. Because of this, there are many couples that actually struggle with becoming pregnant, not because there's anything biologically wrong with either spouse, with either husband or wife, but because the halachot that they observe make pregnancy unlikely or impossible. It's a real challenge for some couples. It doesn't come up all the time, but it comes up some of the time. The approaches that seem to be dealt with or that seem to be taken is that the 5-day period, I don't know if you remember, so I'm talking about, let's say, 5 days of waiting during the menstrual flow followed by 7 days of counting. There's leniencies poskim are much more willing to relax the leniencies around that of 5 days, and to say that right after, if a woman's menstrual flow is only 3 days, then starting day 4 she starts the count, and then you end up having a 10-day long period before she can go to the mikvah, as opposed to 12 days, maybe sometimes 11 days. Often that can help. There are other approaches to this, but another major leniency is using artificial insemination before a woman has gone to the mikvah. So if she can, let's say, ascertain that every month her ovulation happens at day 12, but she's only going to the mikvah at day 12, then many poskim will say then she can go on day 9 or 10 for artificial insemination, and that might be a way to become pregnant. It's a pretty drastic measure, but it is something that many poskim recommend. And in areas with larger Jewish communities, the fertility clinics are actually aware of this as a reality. I thought it was important to talk about that. Okay, next topic, as we're just kind of going through this review, is the question of wasting seed, hashkata zera. So I mentioned again that that's a prohibition in the Torah, either biblical or rabbinic. We could have an entire class just on that one issue alone. But where this comes up mostly is when a couple is initially realizing that they're not getting pregnant, and now there has to be an exploration of what's the cause behind it. And you have to test the sperm to see if the sperm is limited from any number of reasons. So what that actually often requires is testing sperm requires some form of ejaculation. Plus, we're all grown-ups here, so can use real words. So how can that be done? One approach is to say that even manual ejaculation, masturbation, if it's done for the sake of trying to have a child, right, is not considered wasting seed, right? The prohibitions around wasting seed come up around Aaron Onan and Bereishit in Genesis, or the whole point of the whole story and the whole prohibition, what I think in English we call Onanism, right, is trying to spill seed in order to not have a child. But if the purpose is you're ejaculating in order to have your sperm tested so that you can find out if you're able to get pregnant, then that just obviates the entire issue entirely. Rav Moshe Feinstein takes a much more cautious approach, and you'll see this in many poskim. He actually, poskim discuss how there's like a kind of hierarchy of preferences when it comes to what to do. The best case scenario is to remove semen from a couple after intercourse has taken place. The next recommendation is to use a medical condom with a hole in it. The idea of the hole in it is that at least there's the potential for life, there's the potential for insemination. The next one there is that you'd use an unpunctured medical condom, and finally manual ejaculation. These are very sensitive questions. They do come up, and it's important to just be able to talk about them. It's also worth mentioning that many post-game, I think virtually all post-game, unless if you're kind of in the extreme sovereign camp that say like you can only rely on whatever God allows you, will allow freezing of semen in cases of medical need. So I think the cases where freezing semen come up the most is around young cancer patients, where their cancer treatments, I think it's particularly radiation more than chemo. So, again, actually, that's your...
That's more, it's either one. It's okay. More chemo than radiation.
Okay. So cancer treatments can often reduce fertility, both male and female fertility. And so many post-chem will say, even if there's a teenager involved, that they can basically ejaculate, can collect their semen, or in the case of women, fertilize. In the case of women, freeze their eggs so that after going through these treatments, their potential to have a child is not significantly reduced or as insignificantly reduced as possible. One of my close friends had cancer as a high schooler, and this was part of their reality when they were 17 years old, that they had to make this decision for themselves. And they spoke to rabbis, they spoke to experts in the field, and made the decision to follow this approach. Thank God they now have happy and healthy children, which is beautiful. Okay, a question that's asked that I'll just refer to in passing is, I mentioned that the mitzvah of puravu in the Talmud is assumed to be a man's mitzvah, not a woman's. And so is puravu fulfilled through artificial insemination? It's where there's not actually an act of intercourse. Some people point out that there's a convenient statement from Ben Zoma in the Talmud. This is source 8, where Ben Zoma says that it is possible to become for a woman to become pregnant by taking a bath. And we're talking about a bathhouse here, where whatever was left in the bath is probably still in the bath. And if there had been semen left in the bath, Ben Zoma suggests the possibility that a woman could become pregnant. What that opens up, though, for many poskim, and again, not again, poskim are looking for precedents in the Talmud and in the Torah to find halachic sources that one can lead modern phenomena. One can lean onto when evaluating modern phenomenon is that, well, if it's possible to establish pregnancy without intercourse, then maybe paternity can be established without intercourse as well. And so you have poskim that say that you can fulfill artificial insemination by doing artificial insemination. Sorry, you can fulfill the mitzvah peruvu of creating children through artificial insemination. I think, again, in the modern Orthodox community, that's just taken for granted. It's assumed that IUIs, artificial insemination, that IVF, all fulfill the mitzvah peruvu. I mentioned before that can be done even during the 7 days of counting during a woman's menstrual, after a woman's menstrual cycle, which makes it possible in cases of halachic infertility. In the question of male paternity, a major question comes up around sperm donors. So what is the recommendation around sperm donation? So most poskim, Rav Moshe and others, are very concerned if a couple cannot conceive and the cause is established to be likely male infertility, then poskim will say, if you have to have a sperm donor, best that it's not a Jewish sperm donor. There's a strong preference against having a Jewish sperm donor. The reasons for that, if I understand them correctly, is that technically speaking, biblically, we have not done this for 1,000 years, but biblically a man can have 2 wives, but a married woman cannot sleep with anyone but her one husband. That's called the prohibition of Eshet Ish. And if a woman becomes pregnant with another Jewish man's sperm, it brings up questions of, well, that would have been a prohibited relationship, right? Had they actually slept together, right? Genetic sperm donor with woman, with married woman, then the child would be a mamzer, would be not part of the halachic community. Sometimes the term used is a bastard, but I don't think it's a good description of the word mamzer. And so better that the sperm donor is non-Jewish, which would not actually create mamzerut, a non-Jewish...
Mamzer is only when the father is
Jewish. Yeah, it's only when the father is Jewish. So better to have a non-Jewish sperm donor. This creates major challenges, though. For both experiential and halachic challenges. The other question that comes up, the Talmud is deeply concerned with siblings marrying each other without knowing. That's a concern that comes up throughout the Talmud. Now, it's a much bigger problem biologically for men than it is for women, because women basically know who they gave birth to. Right? There's a question of maybe a woman gave up a child for adoption, but generally speaking, a woman knows what child came out of her womb. Right. On the other hand, men potentially, right, just biologically, could have sex with a whole number of women and never keep track of who they slept with. Right? And now all of a sudden, you have half-siblings meeting each other 25 years later, don't know that they're actually related, and could potentially become each other's partners. And that would create incest, biblical incest, which again creates mamzerut if the couple has a child. So that would be obviated if you don't use Jewish sperm donors, because that way you don't have to worry about the halachic sibling relationship if the father is not halachically Jewish. And so that's a strong, strong recommendation. I mentioned that the other issue is that using non-Jewish sperm donors come up with its own challenges. So I'll skip around and just do one of them. There's a case that came up where a couple wanted to have children and there was male infertility, which means that the husband's sperm were not viable. And the husband was a Kohen, was a priest. So here's the question. If they go to a sperm donor, a non-Jewish sperm donor, right, and the woman conceives with the non-Jewish sperm, those children have no, strictly speaking, halachic relationship with the father who's raising them, which means that you can have a son of a Kohen who is not going to be a Kohen. And this could be extremely uncomfortable, particularly in insulated Orthodox communities, where 13 years from now, right, the child has a baby boy, and the father is going to go up to Dochen to bless the people during Rosh Hashanah, Sukkot, in Israel every single day, where they do Birkat Koni and the priestly blessing. And his 13-year-old son isn't going to go up with him. And so the couple asked, can we use IVF, instead of just doing intrauterine insemination, instead of using artificial insemination, can we go through IVF, in vitro fertilization, and then do genetic testing on the embryos, PGD testing, to make sure that we will only have girls, so that no one will ever know, right, when the father goes up to say the priestly blessing, no one will ever know that his children are not halachically his own genetic material.
So,
yeah.
Kohen cannot be adopted.
Correct.
Kohen is only biological.
Yeah.
Sons.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, obviously, yes, but what is the source for that?
Yeah, it's more that paternity in the Talmud is primarily established by intercourse. I didn't actually quote this, but there are numerous sources that suggest that paternity is established in the moment of conception, and maternity is established, this is actually debated, but maternity might only be established at the moment of birth.
So according to Allah,
which intuitively makes sense, because in the 9-month journey of creating a child, the father's biological job is done. Hopefully there's lots more that the father does from that point on, but the father's biologic work is done, you know, the moment of conception. Interesting questions also come up. If you just want to divert in that direction, what if a man has sex with a woman and she becomes pregnant, but he immediately after there dies, and his wife is pregnant but does not yet have a child, and this man had a brother? There's the mitzvah of yibum, of levirate marriage. So is there an obligation of levirate marriage, of yibum, if the father is dead before he has his child, but there's actually a child in his now widowed wife's womb? I won't answer that for now. I'll leave it for another time.
Are there not things incumbent on Bate Kohen that would...
There are some restrictions around Bate Kohen.
But they're not considered important enough in that particular context.
They're much less significant concerns, okay, particularly just in the halachic process. There are still ultra-Orthodox communities that will say that a Bat Kohen, the daughter of a Kohen, should not marry a convert, but I think that's relaxed in other okay communities. There's more there, but for practical purposes, it's often more lenient.
Somewhat
yeah
related. When we adopted our children, we were told that some communities might say our son's Hebrew name is Yaron, that it would be Yaron Ben Avraham, it wouldn't be Yaron Ben, and then my husband's name.
Yeah.
But we were told that there's a leniency that he uses my husband's name.
Yeah, that comes up a lot. That's often an area of halacha that I don't talk about in public, and only in private.
Okay.
Do I have your permission? Now that you just share your personal information. There's the question of what is halachic paternity and maternity is a very relevant question to how a person is referred to in halachic documents, and in how they're called up to the Torah.
Inheritance
is a big one as well. I'd say also prayers, mm-hmm, if you're praying for someone.
And part of this was also because of the conversion process of it too.
So in Allison's case, right, Allison has two lovely children who converted shortly after being adopted, and they're, technically speaking, the Talmud says that a ger is ketino shenola dami, that a convert is like they were just born as a baby, which is in terms of their halachic identity, they're considered as if they were reborn, and they don't have a halachic relationship, at least biblically, a halachic relationship with their birth parents. Rav Soloveitchik says that doesn't apply necessarily to mitzvahs of honoring your parents, there's still a rabbinic obligation to marry, to honor birth parents, even if a person is converted afterwards. That's a much broader question. When it comes to the halachic identity, there's a lot more room for leniency when it comes to how a person is referred to colloquially, like how is a bar mitzvah boy called up to the Torah. Much more room to just be lenient, because calling them up, it just has to be a name that they know to, that they know is associated with them. But then it's a much bigger question when it comes to halachic documents. Somewhat for ketuvahs, for marriage contracts, even more so for divorce contracts, which are much stricter than marriage contracts. So in cases of adoption, the Talmud already has a term for this. It'll say so-and-so, ben or bat, so-and-so, hamigadla, or hamigadlo. So-and-so, the child of so-and-so who has brought him up or brought her up. So it's actually a halachic term for adoptive parents, which is hamigadlo or hamigadla, one who's raised him or her. But yeah, again, in terms of sibling relationships and parental relationships and any question of arayot, which are the prohibited sexual relationships, those become obviated if a person converts to Judaism. The last question, and this happens to be a very sensitive one, is around maternity issues. It's more complicated and it's more debated. So the questions around maternity primarily come up when there is an egg donor or when there is a surrogate. It's really either of those. So just to go through the case again, a couple wants to have a child and the eggs, for whatever reason, of the mother are not viable or not usable. And so they go and they find an egg donor to provide eggs. I'd use the word donate, but it's not an inexpensive process on its own. And so a woman very generously gives weeks or months of her life, goes through hormonal treatments, gets 5 or 10 eggs that are then inseminated with the husband's sperm and are then placed into the wife's womb. And hopefully they carry through term. So what is the status of that child? What's the halachic status of that child in terms of who its mother is? So traditionally, there are a number of poskim traditionally who assumed that the gestational carrier, the actual womb that carried the baby to term, should be treated as the mother. Interesting precedents for this, I'll just name one or two of them. There's a midrash quoted in the Targum Yonatan about Dina and Yosef. Leah gives birth to Dina, according to the Torah. That's verse 9 in Bereishit chapter 30. But there's a midrash quoted in the Targum Yonatan that says that Leah was actually Leah conceived someone else. Leah conceived Dina, and Leah conceived Yosef, and Rachel conceived Dina. But Leah felt terrible that she was going to now have more than 6 of the tribes of Israel. And so she prayed to God for there to be a swapping of pregnancies. And God listened and granted her desire. I can't speak to how any of this works. And then Leah is able to give birth to Dina. And Rachel is able to give birth to Yosef. But some of the poskim point out that the verse in the Torah says, V'achar yalda bat v'tikra et shema Dina, that Leah afterwards gave birth and called her daughter Dina. And so the Torah calls Dina the daughter, the bat of Leah. And so that's a proof for some poskim that maternity is established based on who you give birth to, right? And not where the genetic material comes from, right? Because according to this midrash, right, the genetic material of Dina was actually born in Rachel, came from Rachel. There are other examples of this too, but let's hold off on those for now. So it seems like the earlier postgame assumed that maternity was determined by the gestational carrier. However, Rav Eliashiv and others take the approach that the genetic material, as in the egg donor, is the halachic parent. So I want to bring this back to Jewish halachic status for a minute. So what's preferable here when one is seeking out a surrogate or an egg donor, right, who should one seek after? So with sperm donation, right, if you have a non-Jewish sperm donor, you get around certain challenges, and the child is still Jewish. Right, but when it comes to egg donation, right, the not only is maternity based on that question, but also the Jewish status of the child is based on who the halachic mother is. And so the original poskim suggests that you can have non-Jewish egg donors. Right? The earlier poskim, Ravar and Soloveitchik and others, that you can have a non-Jewish egg donor donate her eggs, and then the embryo is carried in the womb of a Jewish mother, and the child is born, like, let's say, the Leia giving birth to Dina example, the child born is Jewish. But then the poskim who say that, no, it really is the egg donor whose status determines halachic Jewishness, right? Then they would say that, no, if the egg donor was not Jewish, then the child's not Jewish. And so you actually have a major debate in the poskim. In many circumstances, is a child Jewish or not? The consensus right now, and this could change in the Orthodox community, is to basically just either find a Jewish egg donor and a Jewish gestational carrier, or let's say if it's a couple that's trying to have a child, but the woman can't hold a pregnancy to term, that she uses her eggs with a Jewish surrogate. It's basically, you try your best to have both of those cases be Jewish women. And if that's not the case and only one of them is Jewish, no matter who the poskim are at this point, everyone seems to be recommending you try to do a giur l'chumra. You do a conversion out of stringency. Right? Like, even if I'm right, I still want to do it so that, you know, so-and-so whose son is going to want to marry my daughter in 25 years won't have to ask any questions. And so we tend to do a giur l'chumra, a conversion out of doubt or a conversion out of stringency. Another thing, and this is debated itself, is if you are able to find a Jewish egg donor, right, does that egg donor have to be a single egg donor, or could it be a married egg donor? That ends up impacting what your pool is also. I just want to point out that in our journey, we were very fortunate to find an organization called the Jewish Blessing that operates out of Israel and Florida. And they're one of the two or three organizations in the world, to my knowledge, that keeps a database of Jewish egg donors and Jewish surrogates. It's much, much harder to find a Jewish surrogate than it is to find a Jewish egg donor. At any time, they have between 15 and 20 Jewish egg donors. And it's interesting, they kind of categorize the egg donors on different statuses. So there's Jewish Orthodox standards and Jewish conservative standards, and then I think they had a few donors, and you don't know what their names are, who were paternally Jewish but not maternally Jewish. It's just interesting. They keep like a kind of variety of options. And it ends up being like, just because we've gone through it, it ends up becoming almost like speed dating, but with genetic material, where you end up like looking at like what's the parent's personality and what did they look like as a kid. You could choose not to look at pictures, but then you get descriptions of like what color hair did they have. It's fascinating. I just want to refer you to other organizations that can be really helpful if you or anyone you know happens to have challenges around fertility. Machon Pua is the organization in Israel that's done a lot of the heavy lifting on the research around new fertility treatments available and the halachic statuses of them. Yoetzet.org is the organization by Nishmat in Israel that trains Yoetzet Halacha. Those are women who become experts in statuses of Jewish law and Jewish marital law that primarily can have a lot to do with fertility. Yesh Tikva is run by friends of ours in LA that offers support to Jewish couples going through fertility challenges with a focus on Orthodox. Chasida, other friends of ours, Rabbi Edith Solomon in Berkeley, who provide grant funding for Jewish couples or couples trying to bring Jewish kids into the world. She has, I think, a very beautiful and simple pitch, which is basically that Jewish funders and foundations and federations spend hundreds of thousands of dollars and millions of dollars basically trying to ensure that Jewish teenagers become Jewishly engaged college students and Jewish college students become Jewishly engaged young professionals. And very few dollars are being spent on creating Jewish children in the first place. And her organization is there to create grants and support around fertility. And I mentioned a Jewish Blessing. That's a Jewish database and donor base for people seeking out Jewish egg donors and Jewish surrogates as well. There are many more resources available. If anyone would like to talk, or if you know people who would like to talk about these challenges, I'd be happy to talk to them. I hope this gives you a little bit of an overview. The time is late, but if anyone has feel free to go. And if anyone has questions, I'll stick around for a little bit longer. Thank you all so much for being here. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Question.
Sure.
So we talked about the some of those people are saying that they go against IVF and interventions.
Yeah.
And what is the source for that?